You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 47, where we will discuss Aubert & Wetton's 1985 text, Organizational Identity. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Ralph Soule coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico, where it's chilly harvest season.
I'm Greta, and I'm enjoying the sunny weather in Oxford, UK.
And this is Tom calling you from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the United States, where it's we're just finishing a heat wave. Okay, so how is everybody doing?
Doing very well. I thought the reading was very interesting, and it's warm here in Albuquerque, but we don't get the same kind of heat you do in the East Coast.
Yeah, this is more of a wet heat than a dry heat out there in New Mexico.
That's right. We'd actually like some of your humidity.
Okay, so today's reading is a book chapter. As some of you know, certainly the other podcasters know, my background is not in social science. It was in hard sciences. So one of the things that I found fascinating, as I spent a lot of time working at higher headquarters in the U.S. military, was how these headquarters attempted to project themselves, project their mission, explain who they were, and that was for the purposes of being able to garner resources to contribute to other military activities, etc. And a couple of episodes, I found that the concept of the organization's identity was central to its ability to communicate. And one particular example I can highlight, which is going to be in a forthcoming book in a couple of months from the War College Press, is about the formation of a new command. It was called United States Africa Command, which was formed in 2007. And in very, very briefly, we can touch on more details later, but just very briefly, it was formed at a time when the United States was perhaps not as popular in the world due to what was going on in the Middle East at the time. And in particular, the idea of setting up a special command to handle military activities in Africa was most definitely unpopular from both within the United States government and from African organizations, governments, people, etc. And so when I was in that command, in a matter of 2 years of hard work, they managed to turn the perceptions around. And so then when I went through my doctoral program with Ralph at the George Washington University, one of the things that was in the back of my mind as I was, you know, getting into the organization studies field was, why did that work? What was it about that worked? And one of the things that I ran across in the course of learning about organization culture and organization identity, of course, was this particular book chapter by Aubert & Wetton from 1985. And as I read through this chapter, a lot of lights went on. So this is what was kind of going on, even though none of us in particular knew it at the time. And so after finishing the chapter and then subsequently moving on to work at the Army War College, I found myself going back to this book chapter a lot when it came to talking with organizations about organizational change, organizational culture, strategic communication, a whole bunch of things. Because I found that you would think that most people would be able to readily answer a simple question like, who are we? And yet most members actually have some difficulty doing that because they can answer the question from their individual perspective, but they may struggle from a collective perspective, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, in fact, I think one of the challenges there is to get people to consistently answer that question, right? It's one thing for Ralph to be in the same organization as Tom and say, well, I think we're doing this or I think we're doing that. But to the extent that organizational identity drives individual identity as well as organizational mission and commitment,
one of the things I think both you and I have experienced, Tom, is the importance of having a unified or coherent view, is maybe the best way of saying it, to understand and communicate, like you said, what things are about. And I did want to say one more thing about your comment about the setting up U.S. Africa Command, which I think is a great example. One of the things that U.S. military and its approach to global security was, it was in transition back in the time that we set up U.S. Africa Command. Not only were we not necessarily getting the best press, but I think we were, particularly the U.S. Army, were rethinking what's it mean to have influence? And then is the role of the military just to blow things up, right? Is that what we're supposed to be doing? Or is it more a condition of global security, or a mission of global security, and helping nations do those kinds of things? And I'm hoping you're going to cover some of that stuff when you talk about U.S. Africa Command, because I think as an outsider, I think that's part of what we were coming to understand. But I'm very interested to hear later, maybe in the second or third parts of the podcast, your perspective on that.
Yeah, and you bring up some excellent points that, you know, the organization identity, and Albert and Wetton really cover this very well in the reading. Organization identity is not just a difficult and confusing kind of a construct, but it's also something that's time dependent. And so how, you know, there are so many different ways to look at how you can answer who are we? And you touched on, you know, I think it's one thing and somebody else within the same organization thinks it's another. What about external stakeholders? You know, it's when they look at an organization and say, you know, or ask the question, who are you? And then there's time. I mean, who the organization is today is very much going to be different from what it is sometime in the future. And yet, one of the things that the article points out is that there is a sense of continuity. That yes, some of the character of the organization changes over time, but the claims that it makes about who they are as an organization, there's some durable aspects to it. And so, I think what I'd like to do is to, first I'd like to offer to Greta, do you have anything, to add to that before we start getting into the details of the reading?
No, I don't, Tom. This was exactly what struck me, is about like the changing nature of identity, but also the focus on durability and continuity and the definition of organizational identity. And maybe that's also the difference between like organizational image or character and what is organizational identity, I thought.
Yeah, and I will definitely... We'll definitely talk about organizational image as part of this episode, because you're absolutely right. There's after Albert and Wetton, there were a number of seminal articles on organizational image that touched on a lot of the same ideas. What I wanted to kind of start with, and perhaps we can even do this as a neat little bit of a demonstration exercise. The first thing, of course, was for the authors to just sort of lay down how do people answer the question. And the way that they presented is a set of three types of claims. And one of them was claim central character. And claim central character is something that distinguishes the organization. And I'm reading right off of page 266. Something that distinguishes the organization on the basis of something important and essential. So obviously, there's the who are we? We are a podcast, okay? We are a podcast team. We are a team of scholars. But then what Albert and Wetton are talking about is something that is central, that distinguishes us, which makes us very different from, say, other podcasts. And so, you know, I was actually thinking about, you know, reading this article. Okay, so like, for example, who are we as the Talking About Organizations podcast? What is our central character? Let me get through the other two categories, and then we can discuss how we might answer that.
Yeah.
I'd love that.
Yeah, that's good.
Second one is a criterion of claim distinctiveness, how we separate ourselves from others. And then the claimed temporal continuity, which is another way of saying historical, you know, history. And I think many of us have been in organizations that have a long, long history. You know, the universities that we're in or the institutions that we serve. But we all know that who we were 50 years ago, 100 years ago does not in any way resemble who we are now. But we still draw a lot of our claims back from history, do we not? I mean, it's certainly military organizations and, well, you'll watch commercials on TV and think about how many organizations say since 1839 or 1841, as if that has anything to do with what they would do for you today, you know?
Right. When in fact, they're totally different than they were back then. And along that lines of the temporal continuity, I mean, there's certainly some things that are consistent, but one of the things I'm always struck with as somebody who's interested in history is when you read about U.S. history and the U.S. Civil War, to me, it's fascinating to see the different character of the officer corps and how they functioned and how that was and how very different it is. I mean, certainly at the fundamental tactical level, a lot of the same stuff was going on, but at the senior officer level and how you recruited people and those kinds of things, it was a totally different army, and I'm sure the Navy back in those days. And so that's one thing that just jumps off the page at me when I read about Civil War history. The battles are always interesting, but I love that interplay of the officer corps and how they interacted with the politicians. So I think that's a great example, Tom, about the fact that you'd actually, I think, given the fact that our own personal experience is we're not the same people we were 20 or 25 years ago. Some core things are the same, but we've changed, and so you'd expect the organizations to change in some way. In fact, I think that's one of the really interesting features of the article is Albert and Wenton go into quite a bit of detail about that temporal aspect of organizational identity. So, when you were talking about the central character, I thought that was a great example of thinking about in our podcast, right? So one of the things that struck me as central character, and this is the way I describe it to people. So I have sort of a general idea of what our central character is, and that way I can expand or contract as necessary. But when I'm explaining to other people what it's like to listen to our podcast, I say, imagine that you went into a pub or a bar or some establishment and you heard three people, organizational scholars, discussing some article, and you walked up behind them in the chairs and they didn't have any problem with you approaching and they didn't stop and they just kept talking about the articles and what interested them. And every now and then we'll get some suggestions for doing things differently and how we should have more references to the literature and the other works. And one of the things that we like to do is talk quite a bit more about our personal experience and how things that we found interesting, right? So I would say that was that aspect of we choose these articles, we read them and discuss them. And one of our emphases is what we find interesting and how we connect it to what our research is or things we've seen in the world. So that would be my contribution to the central character of our podcast.
Now, as one of the originating hosts, of course, your perspective has a much longer history. So let me now turn to Greta, who is one of our newest hosts. So how would you answer the question of what is our central character?
You're putting me really on the spot, Tom. I think what is our central character when you think of the position of the podcast in our field of work, in our profession, is to going back to audio, where we moved to the internet, we moved to, we do a lot of paper writing instead of books, but the podcast is the active discussion in the podcast. And that's what I think distinguishes us from just a website about organization theory, for instance, the Academy of Management website, or a journal paper. We chose for the podcast, for the audio, for the active debate. And I think that is the central character of us, is talking about organizations.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And we distinguish ourselves by our choice of topic, perhaps, you know, because we do focus on organization studies, and we have put greater emphasis on, say, older texts rather than contemporary. Although we have done some episodes on very, very new articles, we mostly focus on older stuff. And we've also had, in terms of temporal continuity, There's a lot of things in which we've done which have changed over time, which we've captured yes. quite a bit, such as the introduction of episodes focused on events and the introduction of guests, because originally we didn't have guests until until some of the later episodes.
And I would say one of the other distinctive characteristics is we like the freedom, and this came up in our conversations about episode planning and what we want to do. We like the freedom of choosing our own text. We have experimented where we'll get a sponsor and they'll say, here's the text we want you to read and the guests you want to have. And I think we all learned from that and enjoyed it. And I believe we decided we like it better when we get to choose what we're going to read and what we're going to discuss based on our interests. And I do want to comment on Greta. You did a great job, Greta, after being put on the spot. And I think it's very interesting to hear you talk about that accessibility aspect of our podcast, right? Where we're trying to reach the audience differently, and yet we're not just talking about popular topics. As Tom noted, we try to talk about the management classics, current events, current things. We have recordings from conferences and those kinds of things. And unfortunately, our audio quality suffers a bit when we do that. But we try to be dynamic in our choice of topics and the things that we choose to discuss.
Yeah, I completely agree. And to add to that, I think what is also distinctive is the empirical fields we're all in as podcasters. So we have the Navy, we have the Army. I did my dissertation research in a very traditional Japanese multinational, current research in the gig economy, Silicon Valley, and Pedro has a very interesting setting. So we bring like all our different experiences to the podcast and really think and talk about organizational topics and shed light on different theories or different contexts from our experience in these empirical settings.
Yeah, and one more comment on the distinctiveness, because I think that was a great observation, Greta, is that what I think makes us distinctive is we don't come to the podcast with an agenda to push, and we look for things that we find interesting. But one of the things I love about participating, and I hope our listeners get a similar benefit, is I learn something from the other hosts every single time, because I don't always see the same things that they do in the recordings. And so that's one of the things that really makes me look forward to doing the recordings and hearing other perspectives. So I think that kind of makes us distinctive, because there's a lot of podcasts where people are transmitting, they're transmitting information, which is good. I just like the fact that all three of us in this podcast are learning in real time.
Yeah. That's an excellent point, Ralph. And what this discussion sort of illuminates is sort of the benefit if you have a pretty clear idea of what your organization's identity is based on these claims. You know, the we're only talking an organization that's just a handful of people, right? So it's perhaps a little bit easier for us as a small group to be able to explain who we are, who we think we are, and, you know, even though we do have some slight differences in perspectives, we have a greater sense of who we are as a whole organization. But when we're talking about larger organizations, it gets a little bit more complicated. And when we think about cases where we go to organizations that perhaps don't have a very clear sense of their own identity, answering these kind of a question, it actually can be much more difficult. And an example that I can certainly give is when an organization is going through change, due to an external event where, you know, say you have to get out of your original line of work, your original business, your original mission, and adopt something else entirely. That can be extremely disruptive to an organization, can it not?
Right. And I would say it also includes those cases where you're not necessarily getting out of a line of work, but you're starting a new one. And the authors talk about how that can be gradual and done over, you know, incrementally over time. But the U.S. Africa Command is not a bad example of one where you took people from the larger organization of the Army and the State Department and perhaps the Navy, I suspect, and the other services. And so these people all came with mindsets of what their parent organization identity was. And then you had to form a new organization without necessarily saying, well, we're just going to blend all these other ideas. How do we come up with something new? And I'm sure Tom will be able to talk about that later in the podcast. I would like to, as we're given where we are now, I'd like to just give a brief summary of some of the other major sections of the article, and then we'll, you know, we can go into some details on some of those, but I'm going to get in trouble with Pedro if I don't go, you know, describe some of these things. And so in the section on identity as a statement of central character of the organization, which is what we've been discussing, one of the things I thought was interesting there is that they talk about organizational leaders using identity and central characteristics of the organization to decide what they do and how others would relate to them, which I think is what Tom was talking about. And I think I agree with the authors that retrenchment is one of those clear examples of when that's going to occur. But Tom gave a great example, and I can think of many in the military, where it's not necessarily retrenchment, but it could also be we've had a big problem. So, you know, something didn't go well, or disaster, or somebody was killed in an accident or something, and you have to think about how did we get here and what are we supposed to be doing and is this the right way to do business. And then they also talk about something that Tom was addressing, which is the mono and dual identity organizations. That is a central part of the article, where they discuss this dualism, you know, that you could actually have two identities at once, which I think is fascinating, because it one of these things where you look at the article, and particularly the work that's been done since, as Tom is discussing, and you say, oh, yeah, that's obvious. Well, I don't know if that was obvious at the time, that, you know, where you realize, oh, yeah, you actually can have multiple identities. And I've seen that in organizations. And then you talk about how they relate, and can you always separate them? And
well, the dual identity is something that's very, very common, I would say, in very large organizations, hierarchical organizations. Because, for example, you could be in a very large organization like the Army, and the Army has an identity, okay? And a very, you know, very distinctive claims about who it is, what it's about, its relationship with the public, et cetera. But then when you go down just hierarchically and you go down to a particular part of the Army, and let's just say –
like a branch.
Yeah, what we call branches, infantry against armor, against the support branches like signal or logistics.
Or Rangers, or Green Berets, or paratroopers. I think that's fascinating. All the how the Army has these really kind of distinctive and in some ways culturally separate branches.
But they still all draw identity from the parent organization.
Absolutely. So they have common means for working together, right? So it's not like you're taking somebody from Africa and somebody from Spain and somebody from South America and trying to expect them to all work together and speak the same language. That's what's, I think, fascinating about the way the Army does this, is that they have this Army identity and then a common set of tools and ways of approaching missions or situations. And then as an outsider, it seems to me, they're pretty good about blending the aspects of the different organizations. And I'm sure there's some difficulty and it's not perfect, but I'm sure you saw a lot of that in U.S. Africa Command.
Yeah. And in that particular case, what you had was, you had several dual identity conflicts that were ongoing, because you have, even within, say, the big army, you know, within the overall organization, you know, we've sort of been treating the idea of central character as being I don't want to say monolithic, but that it's somewhat unified and constructive, but it can conflict. Okay. So, and I'll give you an example, and I'm sure there's a lot of organizations that have a similar challenge, in which, on the one hand, in military organizations, you have the combat side of things, and then you also have the non-combat side of things. You have one identity that's associated with being in battle, and you have a different identity that's associated with your time in times of peace, when you're back in garrison doing preparatory work, training, you know, that sort of thing. And in the case of an organization which is somewhat of a cooperative between, say, the Department of Defense and the Department of State, where you're combining aspects of military training and programs with something as culturally different as diplomacy, security cooperation. So it's a very different, the behaviors are different, and therefore you start getting into, you know, a dual identity between, okay, and you're supposed to be hardcore military person on the one hand, and a security cooperation soft power type of an individual on the other at the same time. And you can imagine that, these conflicts can make things very complicated when it comes to at times when you have to reconcile them, especially like when you're under constrained resources and what you think is your core identity is one side and not the other. There may be challenges where you end up having to make decisions about, you know, like in Albert and Wetton, it's one of the hypotheses that they offer is about, you know, what happens if you lose an identity sustaining element? If you are going to forsake resources towards something that you consider to be a core part of who you are, then that can cause all sorts of trouble or problems with the organization maintaining its identity.
Oh yeah. In fact, it goes back to this loss. Are you losing your identity? Are you losing the organization's identity or some aspect of it? And they point out that's almost like losing individual identity. And there are very strong emotions associated with that. And I thought they had a great point on page 273 where they talked about the need for organizational funerals conducted for plants that are closing or subsidiaries that are being sold. You could also extend that to missions that are no longer going to be performed. And in fact, the U.S. Navy does exactly that. So when we decommission a ship, which means take it out of service and we're no longer going to operate it, we actually have a special ceremony for that. It's very important. It's called a decommissioning ceremony. And so we don't just everybody walk off. It's a very formal ceremony where you are essentially retiring the ship and talk about all these great things you just did and the people did. And many of the original ship personnel come and people who served on it over years. And in many ways, it strikes me, it's like a funeral. And I'm sure the Army does the same thing when they disestablish certain commands.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so what you were talking about, Tom, I think rolls into another part of the article, which is the salience of identity over time. And they refer in the article to six conditions. And the six are formation of the organization. That's one. And that's, I think, U.S. And I think they can overlap. And we're going to see that they do. So U.S. Africa Command or commissioning a new ship, which you would think, oh, that's just the same as operating a ship. No, I've commissioned a ship before, and it's quite a bit different. And there's actually times when a ship goes through a long overhaul where it's almost like starting over again. The number two is the loss of identity based on a sustaining element loss, like the loss of the founder. And I think all of us have read some of the self-analysis and re-examination of mission Apple Computer was going through when Steve Jobs left, because he was such a strong force in that company. But he's not the only one, of course. Then the third one, which I think is also very interesting, the accomplishment of the mission, right? Very, very infrequently do you have, okay, we accomplished our mission, so we're just going to disband now. No organizations will come up with something else. And I didn't realize until I read the article that the March of Dimes was formed to combat polio. And then when we essentially conquered that disease in the United States, they moved on to other things like birth defects, which are all great things to work on. But I didn't realize I think Mothers Against Drunk Driving and some others, it's not like that's been solved, but they think about what the change of mission is. They give an example of number four, a couple of them, about extremely rapid growth, right? Because you have all these things going on, and then you have to decide, are we going to focus on this mission or that mission, or does the mission have to evolve? The fifth one is a change in collective status. That's like a nice way to say hostile takeover. But I couldn't resist that one. And then retrenchment is the one they give, you know, many examples of, and particularly in their case study they did in the second part of the paper. But you know, my thinking was there's other times besides retrenchment when of course they do say that in the article that will cause you to reexamine your emphasis on the existing identity. And so a couple more points I want to make before we finish our summary of the episode or the paper is they talk about these times when it seems plausible that you would expect a dualistic shift. Because I thought that was really interesting to think about, well, what are the recurring situations that might lead to this change in identity or this duality of the identity? And they identify four, and there's probably more, which is, number one is the environmental complexity. This idea that as the environment gets more complex, your organization has to get more complex. And some of that's growth, like Tom was talking about, the Army. I think the Army didn't just create all these branches because it was fun. It found that they found useful, really useful situations and then wanted to retain them. And then the Army has to deal with, well, how do we integrate them at these particular times? And then number two was duality by default, where they acquire these multiple identities because I thought this was great. So they say this on 277, because they become the repository of all things that other organizations will not undertake. And I actually lived that experience, because when I went to Pearl Harbor as the operations officer, so the operations officer at a shipyard, it's a Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard, is typically in charge of overhaul and repair work and scheduling of ships going into dry docks and training and those kinds of things. And somebody turned to me and said, well, you actually also own the torpedo handling team. And I said, what? I'm in the shipyard. What do I have to do with torpedo handling other than getting them off the ship so you could do the work? And they said, well, when we were consolidating base activities, they were orphans. And your predecessor said, we'll take them. And so now you're in charge of torpedo handling. And I had no background in torpedo handling. So I thought that was very interesting. And then this idea that it's difficult to divest an identity. And so my short term for that is identities are sticky. It's not so hard to bring them on. It's very hard to stop doing things. And I've seen that particularly in the military.
Yeah.
And then the fourth one was, oh, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say that'll be something we'll want to talk about is identity, in the future part is identity is a barrier, because it can be very enhancing. And I think in a lot of what we've discussed so far is we've touched on ways in which identity can help facilitate an organization's mission. But unquestionably, and we'll get into this soon enough, it can get in the way of some things that you want to do.
Right, right. And that's why I refer to it as sticky. And that's not always a good thing, right? Something is sticking to you. And then the fourth case, they talk about where the duality of organizational identity becomes more plausible is the one I mentioned before about organizational success, right? You've done great things. You don't really have that same mission to apply or accomplish. So now what do? Do you have to redefine the mission? Do you disband the organization? And particularly in government organizations, they almost never disband the organization. They just look for new problems to solve, which that's probably a good thing. I'm not saying that's bad. It's just that's the nature of what they do.
Yeah, it sounds like the garbage can model from episode 39.
What I was thinking about while reading the articles was the organizational change that the company that I studied for my thesis research went through. And this Japanese multinational I call Mirror Corporation, it was a period of during the financial crisis. And they were reorganizing the company, so subsidiaries became united into a division. And they, instead of having like a top management team of each subsidiary, they had to become one top management team of the division, which was kind of a merger of the Japanese management team and the European management team. And here there was a very intense debate about how to go about becoming one divisional organization. And with one way of working, well, you're located in Europe and in Japan, which is very different. And so there was a big debate about what type of organization was Mirai actually. Was it a Japanese multinational, or was it a global multinational? And where the European managers emphasized the global aspect of the company to legitimate that the company had to change and needed to adopt the global work practices, the Japanese part of the organization emphasized the Japanese-ness kind of legitimating the continuity of the work practices they had in place. And this was an intense debate, especially among the managers. And in the end, it was decided that they were a global company, but from Japan. And that was kind of how the CEO tried to solve this issue, saying, yes, we want to operate globally, but we will continue to be and respect that we have Japanese origins. Yeah, so that was kind of what I was thinking about reading this article.
Yeah. And it also kind of brings up, it just sort of shows one of the challenges with the dual identity. It's almost like a dialectic. You basically have these two facets, which in this particular case, what you're describing was shared by two different subcomponents of the organization who are going to wind up having to face this dialectic over and over again.
Over and over. Yes, that's a great way to say it.
So, okay.
The chapter that we read for this episode focused on the meaning, significance, and definition of the term identity as it applies to organization. That's really important. They were taking this individual construct and saying, how do we present this for organizations? And as Tom noted at the beginning, the first part of that is asking a particular kind of question. What kind of organization is this? Which helps you identify features of an organization that are core, distinctive, and enduring. The second aspect of identity is this framework for investigations of organizations that the authors created, which I think is one of their major contributions to the literature. And in the article, the authors conduct a critique of the mono-identity assumption by introducing the concept of dual identity and dualism, and particularly the temporal nature of identity, how it's likely to change over time. And there's a lot of in the article that I would call either spade work or construction or building blocks to build on the identity literature and also make the concept of organizational identities scientifically tractable, in the author's words. And that is to define, analyze, and illustrate identity in such a way that multiple empirical questions and hypotheses become visible. And this is one of the things I thought was unique to the paper I hadn't seen before, is that they present the arguments in the form of 7 empirical questions and 33 hypotheses, if I counted correctly. And so they're not just saying it's all this way. It's actually in the form of hypotheses and questions that could be further researched. So this would be a goldmine for dissertation research or deciding what kind of article you wanted to write back in 1985. It's probably not any good anymore, or may not be as good as it was back then. And that's all for part 1 of episode 47. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Albert and Wetton's 1985 work on organizational identity, here on Talking About Organizations.